Welcome to the Cocktail Lovers Podcast. I'm Sandra.
And I'm Gary.
And together, we are the Cocktail Lovers, a married couple sharing our passion for the artistry of drinks.
We've been writing about cocktails in our eponymous magazine and website, but this is where we talk about cocktails.
In each episode, we'll be sampling the best products, from spirits and mixers to non-alcoholic tipples and pre-mixed drinks, highlighting our pick of books to add to your cocktail library and shining a light on the bars to have on your radar.
We'll also be checking in with some of the biggest names in the business to hear what's going on in their world, as well as asking them for their tips on making quality drinks at home.
We like to think of ourselves as your new best friends, cocktail-wise. So let's hear what's on the show this week.
In this episode, we're on something of an international journey. First, from one of Japan's coldest regions, we'll be tasting the delicious Toku Sake. Then, it's off to warmer climes for the new limited edition Equiano Ominira, a special blend of rums from the Caribbean and Africa. As for our book, we're opening up 101 cocktails to try before you die from Belgium-born but Spain-based Francois Monti. Back in London, Soho, we drop into the brand new incarnation of Three Sheets from Max and Noel Fenning. Finally, we return to Japan, this time to Tokyo, as we catch up with our guest, the fabulous Holly Graham, who tells us all about her new bar, Tokyo Confidential. But first, we are the cocktail lovers, so let's make ourselves a cocktail.
Right, we're kicking off with something a little bit different for us. We love martinis.
We do.
But we're going to have a dirty martini. I don't know why. It's not something that I even order at bars, but actually we'll see at the end. We have done something at the end of this episode.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert, folks. This is one of the reasons why we're doing a dirty martini. But actually, even before we went to review one in the bar that we're going to talk about later, this was the drink that I decided I wanted to make this week. God knows why, but here goes.
Your head, exactly.
So dirty martini. And not only that, I'm going really off-piste for us. I'm doing it with vodka. We love our martinis with gin, but why not vodka? Yeah. That's what I'd say. So it's 60 mil per serve. So nice and generous on the vodka. Ooh. I'm using Elite vodka this week. Because why not? We've got a lovely bottle here. And it is a gorgeous vodka,
it's a gorgeous vodka and a lovely bottle. I'm really looking forward to that.
Also, I think you can use gin, obviously. But I think that vodka is a better canvas for the brine. But what do I know?
I would say.
So 60 ml of vodka. And now we're going with 10 per serve. Of our Dolin vermouth.
So very dry then.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Could do more if you want. This is one of those, I mean, like everything, you can adapt it to what suits your palate, but I'm just going for a general one. Right. Now we have the brine. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, are you a fan of dirty martinis?
I wouldn't say fan, but I do like them. I mean, as and when they take my fancy, I do enjoy them.
Yeah. Well, that's so it takes your fancy today.
Yeah, you've never made me one, so this is a first, yeah.
That brine does smell delicious, I must say. So we've got some lovely pitted green olives there. And now I'm going to add some ice to a mixing glass. It's smelling so lovely and savoury, which is... Actually, I'm in the mood for that today, I think.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? With any drink, but martinis particularly, because there are these like different variations. Yeah. You can sort of play around with where your mood takes you.
Yeah. So, do you know anything about the history of one?
In a word, no.
Right. So apparently, it's believed to have been originated in 1901.
Right.
And it's often credited to a bartender called John O'Connor. I don't know. You know, I mean, it's one of those things. Who knows?
You weren't there, were you?
Wasn't there. Well, yeah, my alter ego may well have been. But it's something that President Roosevelt is very renowned for making for his guests.
Big up President Roosevelt.
Well, there you go. So I'll give him that a lovely stir. Quite cloudy, smelling gorgeous. And now our glasses have been chilling, as always. And right. Where's my little strainer gone? Bloody hell. This joint is really going off, Gary. Okay. Strained into our chilled glasses. And so
good.
Rather than that lovely, clean, you know, that transparent thing that I love with our ordinary dry gin martinis, this has got a cloudiness to it, and as it should be. And now for the extra bit. The good thing about a dirty martini is you get your a little bit of nibble with your with your drink. And I'm going to pierce three olives onto our lovely cocktail stick, inspired
by
very
nice looking olives, by
the review that we're doing later.
Thank you. Here it comes. I'll wait and do a little cheers with you. Oh, nice cocktail sticks. Those nice metal.
Yes.
Very tray elegant, I would say.
And these olives are from the lovely Fortnum and Mason. Yeah. So no messing, my friend.
Here to give you a little cheers. But I like the, you can see the lovely oils from that on the surface.
Yes.
Lovely. It looks very appealing, actually, I must say.
Well, I hope that it tastes good.
Right, quick little
quick
little cheers.
Our dirty martinis. Chin.
Hang on, I'm going in. Wow.
I like that.
I love that.
You know, the thing is, lots of bartenders now are using oil on their drinks, you know, just to give that lovely silky mouthfeel. And this does that very well. Yeah. So big ups a dirty martini.
Absolutely.
So my choice this week is actually something very special. It's from...
We always have special things.
Actually, you're right.
Yeah.
You are right.
I know.
But can I say special, special?
Okay. Super special.
Yeah, because this is actually a special release. And it's we talked actually about Equiano Rum quite a while ago. I think it's maybe about 2 years ago, right at the beginning.
Oh, my God.
Almost when we first started
ago.
Doing this podcast.
But then again, it is such a brilliant, brilliant rum, isn't it?
It is. Mm. And what's really exciting and why I said it's special, this is actually a special release. It's Equiano Ominira.
Right.
And it's a limited edition and it's just about to go on sale, I think, literally within the next week or so. So we're really, really pleased to actually have it here now for us to taste.
So no messing, it really is special.
No, absolutely. And it's the first release of what they're calling their Legacy Blend series.
Right.
And I think it's worth, we talked about this back in the original discussion we had about Equiano, but I think it's worth repeating that everything about it is in honour of and inspired by the journey of the namesake, Alauda Equiano, who he has a fantastic, fantastic story. Back in the 18th century, he was enslaved at 11 years old. He got his own freedom. He taught himself to read, write, to do maths, to trade, and actually through
hero.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And through trading rum, that helped him get his freedom.
Mm.
And then he became a real campaigner for the abolition of slavery.
Yeah, I think people need to read more about him. He's incredible.
He is incredible. And there is, he's actually, there is his autobiography, which you can find out his whole story there, which is called The Interesting Narrative of Alauda Equiano. Now, also worth noting, what's nice about this, before we even taste it, is there's some little really nice nods to his story, which are reflected in the rum itself, in the special edition. As I said, he was kidnapped and sold into slavery 11 years old.
I mean, can you imagine that? That is just bonkers.
It's beyond belief. Mm. And, you know, let's face it, it's still happening in the world today.
Mm.
And I know they make
donations, don't they, from the sale of Ecuardo to help in the fight against modern slavery,
right, which I think is fantastic.
Definitely worth saying. So, yeah, he was kidnapped at the age of 11. So this limited edition rum is an 11-year-old vintage, so it's kind of acknowledging the 11.
Mm.
And likewise, he lived to the age of 52, and so they've bottled it at 52%.
Yeah, that's
so
lovely.
Really nice little nods to his life. It's in the classic bottle, but with a lovely wax dip. Hand that over to you. There you go. So this is, as I say, very special, limited edition.
Beautiful on the nose, isn't it?
Wow. I mean, he didn't even have to lift the glass towards you.
No.
It kind of climbs out the glass towards to you. It's lovely. It's
all sorts of brilliant fruits in there. It brings sunshine to mind for me.
Also,
it's a little smile on
it's,
my face.
I should say it's a blend, as everything they do. It's a coming together, and this is the first Ecuana do, of bringing together rums from the Caribbean and from Africa.
Mm.
And in this case, it's from two very different distilleries. So you've got Foursquare and you've got Grey Distilleries. So those rums together. And the rum is finished in bourbon, cognac and sherry casks.
Yes.
And I really get the sherry from this on the
It's
on the
it's
nose.
Such a beautiful... I mean, you know, I would love this rum anyway. Mm. But the fact that there's so many amazing stories and heritage and just this amazing person that inspired it, and also with Ian Burrell behind it, who is the rum ambassador. If you don't know him, you need to know him 100%. As much as you need to know Alodo Ecuano as well. But the whole care and attention and all of the lovely detail that go into everything that they do with this brand is incredible.
While you were talking there, I was having another little sip
there. Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's, you just
want to
smell
sit back
this
and
forever,
this,
couldn't you?
Yeah.
So what's all the deets, you know, the technical
So as
stuff?
I say, it's about to go on sale. It is a limited edition. There are going to be just 3,000 bottles.
Worldwide.
So, in total, yeah.
Mm,
and for one of those, a 70cl bottle, it's £180, but worth every penny.
Absolutely.
And as I say, donations going to really good causes as well.
Fantastic.
So there we are. That's my first choice.
Lovely. Well done. That's a great choice. Right, Mr. Sharpen, for your delectation, I bring you sake.
Now, that's a bit unusual for us, isn't it?
It really is. But there's so much going on with this, and there's a reason why we're doing this. This ain't any old sake, my friend. This is premium, fantastic, honest to goodness sake that is going to blow your socks off in a great way.
From you.
Okay. First of all, I'm going to pass you the bottle because I want you to explain what's going on here.
It's first. Oh, it's nice and cold. You just,
There's a reason for that, but we'll do that.
I like the bottle. It's quite minimalist. Mm. It's like at first I thought it's because it's cold, but it's
frosted
glass, which is very appealing.
Yeah.
Got a very minimalist black label with gold type.
And turn it round because there's a...
Oh, I see. Is that like one in English, one in Japanese?
Yes.
I get it.
Yeah.
And then there's that nice...
But you didn't describe. So what the front? Was the black and then the gold
and then on the back is a white label, exactly the same shape and size, but that's silver type, but it's Japanese calligraphy.
Mm.
So that's very clever, so you can just turn it round and get the best of both worlds. And then there's like I don't know what you described as. It's like a paper and wonderful cord. It's not a seal. It's kind of covering the cap. It's like a doubly black paper.
Yeah, it's
sort of silver cord.
Untie
very
and
elegant.
Yes,
super
absolutely.
Elegant. Yeah.
And so I'm just taking this off.
Yeah.
And luckily it has got a twist cap. But before we get into what's inside, I just want to say this is called Toku sake.
Right.
And although we usually refer to sake as sake in the UK or generally, it's actually in Japan, the name for it is Nihonshu. Right.
So that is the generic description.
Apparently.
Okay.
Apparently.
All right. I've already learned
Yes. So there's lots of different things. So I'm going to teach you. This is a lesson for you today. So toku, the name of the sake, it actually means virtue and is inspired by the samurai code. And there's seven things that it encapsulates. There's a lot going on here, my friend.
Yeah, I'm all agog.
So there's justice, benevolence, courage, respect, truth, honor, and loyalty.
Wow.
I know.
They're values, aren't they?
Absolutely. So we'll start with where it's brewed.
Yeah.
It's brewed in Ashahi Kawa. So this is the coldest city in a particular region of Japan. And toku is made using time-honored techniques, which have been developed over 120 years.
Is the fact it's in a cold area significant?
It is. It brings all sorts of different qualities. Apparently, it's made using highly polished Yamadana Shiki rice, and it's the best quality rice to make sake.
Oh, okay.
And it's fermented in the region's freezing conditions. So I think that that cold altitude does make a huge difference to it. So,
as I said, that bottle is very cold. So that's part of the serve that you have to
they recommend that you serve it from the fridge at 5 degrees.
Right.
And one of the other things they recommend is that you serve it in wine glasses. So I'm just doing that for you now. So I was lucky enough to go to a lovely dinner that they had the other week.
I remember.
And one of the reasons for that, not just to taste this amazing sake, but actually to introduce their new creative director, who is none other than the amazing Kate Blanchett.
Wow.
And she's one of those people that I really equate with quality. She's very discerning. She's not going to put her name to anything that she doesn't believe in. She is a real fan of Japanese culture, and she's a real fan of really quality brand. She would not sort of endorse anything just for the moolah.
What's she doing actually?
Well, she's creative director, but more than that, she's not just lending her name to it. She's overseeing all of the creative strategy and direction, she's going to be, you know, doing all of the stuff on new product development and innovation. So, okay, I've done all of that. Gary's going in. What do you think? Because you haven't tasted it at all.
No, not at all. This is an absolute first. I keep nosing it. I'm sorry of being a bit rubbish. I can't work it out. It's very fresh and light on the nose, but I can't sort of say, oh, it reminds me of this or that.
No, it's different, isn't it? Yeah. To me, it actually has a bit of funky aroma. Mm. You know what I mean? It is that sort of fermentation thing that you get, but light fermentation, no?
Yeah. Sorry, I've now just had a little sip, and it's I'm going to contradict myself as I speak, but it's kind of delicate, but it's got a lot of intensity.
Yeah, to absolutely.
It.
Yeah. It's very creamy, which is lovely, and also there's a lot of texture to this one, don't you think? Quite silky and
You want to roll it around your tongue. Yeah, kind of got that sort of quality. Is this not just because it's in wine glasses, but is this something that they recommend that you have
with food?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because as I was sipping it, I thought, oh, this would work.
Yes, and they've actually tied up with quite a lot of Michelin starred restaurants, including the Fat Duck and, you know, Pierre de Terre and whatever, because it is such a foodie focused thing. I mean, I remember back in the day when we did drink sake, but it was served at the table and it was warm and it was just horrible, actually.
But it was a very different experience.
But this is much more premium. Is about foodie focused flavors as well.
I would love to have this with some sushi.
Absolutely. And we tried a lot of different cocktails because they've actually worked with Stuart Hudson to develop 7 different types of cocktails. From aperitif style right to an old-fashioned style.
Really interesting.
If you look at the website, you can get information of that.
Maybe we should do that on a future episode, make an old-fashioned with this.
Absolutely, it's really good. So this is toku sake, endorsed and, you know, heralded by its new creative director Kate Blanchett, and it is 16% ABV, so it is lower ABV, but actually it's still quite, not punchy, but there's a lot going
on
there. Intense, that's the word. Yeah. So it's 72 cl, okay, which is quite right, unusual.
All right.
And it's £155 from Hedonism okay. Wines. But you can see and find out more about it on our website and our Instagram feed.
I love that. And now for a cocktail hack from one of our experts.
Hi, my name is Alex Katena, and I'm one of the co-founders of Tavern Elementary. And my cocktail hack today for all the cocktail lovers is don't be afraid of batching. I know cocktail lovers love martinis, and there's no reason why you should be wasting time on stirring martinis. Just batch half a liter of gin, 100 ml of vermouth, and some 150 ml of water. Pop it in the freezer, and in 2 hours, you are hosting an amazing party with all the friends with zero effort.
Book choice. I am going for a book that's not brand new. It's been out, I think, about 7 years. I mean, we've had it a while, but yeah. I was looking around. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's a nice one to have a little chat about.
Okay.
And it's called 101 Cocktails to Try Before You Die. And it's by Francois Monti.
Lovely.
He's a really nice
yeah,
chap.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Isn't he? He's chap, a nice, yes. nice chap.
And a fellow West Ham fan for you, Gary.
He certainly is. It's, yeah, he's from Belgium, isn't he?
Yeah.
But a Belgium West Ham fan, which I love.
Yes, living
anyway,
in Spain.
living in Spain. So anyway, but let's not digress. One of the reasons this jumped out at me, I really like lists. I don't know why. You know these things, you know, like when they have a 100 best classical countdown or your 10 favorite comedies of all time. I never mean to watch them, and then I come in at number 7 and I think I have to, you know, keep going. So this is 101 cocktails, but it's not a list in order of 101 being right what? Down the bottom and number 1 being the
right best. Okay,
it's just he's picked 101 cocktails. But the format is, it's in alphabetical order.
Right.
So it's not about preference or anything. And glancing through it, I'll pass it over to you, but glancing through it, it's kind of a lot of classics in there. And several that jumped out at me, which I'd never heard of. So I think it's a good sort of selection. And I like this idea of a list of 101 cocktails. And you sort of think, oh, okay. And I was looking through it earlier.
How many have you had?
Well, I haven't actually gone through it. I was tempted to do that thing. You know, like when you study and you do actually write in books, which I would never do now. But I thought, oh, maybe I should go through and just put a discreet tick.
I think so. And maybe a little review of what, if you like them or not.
But I mean, you flip through it and you see the ones you would expect to be in there. All the classics are in there. But the format, as I say, it's alphabetical. Each spread there's a lovely photograph of the cocktail. There's notes on its background. There's a very basic description of how to make it. And he's also put in a little thing on, I think he calls it finish. So just like what you might get from it. I think they're his sort of personal observations.
Mm.
But I like this thing that I can dip into that and think, yeah, I've had that. Oh, I don't think I've ever had that.
Mm.
And then you can, you know, because he's got the recipes, you can, if I think most of them I could see are easy enough to make at home. There's nothing in there that I think, oh, God.
Yeah.
That's
well, he's done a lot on the descriptions of the cocktails. That's where I think that this book comes into its own, isn't it? You know, that there's a lot of Francois' knowledge that he has that goes into each of those 101 cocktails. So, yeah.
I think what's also good, it's funny because you say, like, his knowledge comes in, which absolutely does. But at the same time, it's not overly scholarly. I like his chatty tone of voice. And bearing in mind, it was originally written in French and then translated. I think it's retained a really nice tone of voice, which is very chatty. And there was one I was looking at earlier, and he was sort of talking about his personally not liking overly sweet drinks, but why he liked this one. And it felt like he was really having a nice little conversation with you about it.
Okay.
So I really like this. 101 Cocktails to Try Before You Die by Francois Monti. It's available. It's from Octopus and it's just £10.
The brand new issue of the Cocktail Lovers magazine is out now and it's dedicated to the amazing women working in the drinks industry. From the change makers to the bar and brand owners and the men they've inspired, it's our way of saying that we celebrate women all year round, not just in March. To get your print or digital issue, or to start a subscription, simply visit thecocktaillovers.com/magazine.
So this is very hot off the press because we went yesterday, didn't we?
Yeah, I like that, actually. Yeah. You know, I think with our last one, we did something that we'd just been to. Oh. And now we're doing another one that we've just been to. So I think we should stick to that format. It's quite nice and fresh and bouncy, you know?
Bouncy. Right. So where did we go yesterday?
We went to Three Sheets, but not Three Sheets.
In Dalston.
Original Guys in Dalston, which opened in 2016. Can you believe it? Right. So now they've opened up a new one. This is the brothers, Max and Noel Venin. They've opened up the new Three Sheets in Soho. I call this Soho Light rather than Soho Heavy. You know what I mean?
Do you want to explain but they've opened it up. Our listeners, what you mean by that?
What Soho Light? And actually, I love Soho Light. Let me say, it is on just on the outskirts of Soho before you get into the madness, particularly at the weekends when you've got everyone just like out and loud and bonkers. This is
edge, isn't
that? Should we say sophisticated? I don't know. I mean, for me, it is. Yeah. It's just a lovely part of Soho. So you get that energy, you get that vibe, but you don't get the craziness that's going on in the main throng.
So that is Soho Light.
I don't call it Soho Light. This is my perfect Soho. Some people call it Soho Light.
Okay.
But anyway, so this is a new part. And I think we've mentioned it a bit before because there's a lot going on here now. So
there really is.
We've got Three Sheets, which we'll talk about in a minute. But we've actually got over the road is Wacky Wombat. Just a few steps away, we've got Dram, which we mentioned in our last season. Then we've got Atelier Coupette, which is not too far away. You've got Bar Termini there, and then also we've got Swift, which is one of the original
and you
ones
can walk
in that
between that it's whatever amazing. That was 5-6 bars.
That's a little
there. None of them are more than 5 minutes away from each
and
other.
All of them serving amazing drinks. I think, you know, this is real quality Soho. That's what I'm going to say.
Absolutely.
Forget Soho Light. This is quality Soho. So, okay, so Three Sheets. So it's when we visited, which was yesterday, it was just 3 weeks old. So I think that's quite nice on our keeping it in with the three theme.
Yeah.
They also have three bars. So there is Three Sheets in Dalston. They're part of Little Mercies that we've also reviewed. In Crouch End. And now this is its third guys or third iteration. So what do you think?
Well, first off, let's just say a little bit about the look of the bar. Because outside, that whole area that you were just describing with some of those bars, they've been renovating it for so long. I mean, we walked through there all the time.
Ridiculous.
It's years.
Yes.
It's where, for the people who know, it's where the old Foyles bookshop used to be, is sort of on that corner.
Yeah.
But they've been renovating it for, anyway, thank goodness it's done. It's open.
It's opened up.
But that little bit outside of Three Sheets, it's pedestrianized. Mm. Which is nice. So, you know, it's got a nice relaxed vibe as you approach. It's got those sort of doors that you can open onto the pedestrianised area. So I guess in the summer they might have tables and chairs outside.
I really hope so. I think that they're in the process of trying to get planning permission for that. But it lends itself to that, you know.
And even like when we went yesterday and it's sort of early spring, it had lots of natural light pouring in, which was lovely. And, it's quite a smallish bar.
Yeah. But bigger than Three Sheets in Dalston, you know.
True.
So it has got that, and it really has the DNA of Three Sheets in Dalston.
Yeah.
It's minimal, it's light and airy, quite small, but in a way that it feels, I don't know, there's an airiness about it, which is lovely.
And that's partly the natural light, but also I think the design.
The design is quite pared back. But they both have that lovely signature, really deep green that is and the back bar of the walls, but then there's also they intersperse that with the white walls as well, plus natural daylight that comes through. So and then this marble bar top,
signature. And also they don't have, it's all seated, so we sat at the bar because that's our favorite place. But there's a couple of small booths which I thought they look really nice for groups of like four or something, or a date if you can do that. And then there are a few little tables,
so it's about eight tables. So all in all, I think they said it would seated about 40. And so you can do walk-ins, particularly at the bar, but for seating at the actual tables and stuff, it's worth booking. But one great thing about it is it's open from Tuesdays, but from 12 p.m. So it's amazing. They do great coffees in the day, but if you fancy it, why not? Just go for a cocktail. Why not?
I think we might experiment with that.
We might, because it's quite close to us. So anyway, we were hosted by Jack Kopak, who is the host of the whole place. And he takes time to come and sit next to you or talk to you if you want to go through the menu.
Yeah.
But the team itself is amazing. So this is where Max is going to be based, and Noel will be Noel will be at the Dalston branch along with Rosie, who is amazing. But we've got a great team here, including Matthew Galloway, who's fantastic. And they just make some amazing drinks. So
there was really good energy as well. I was going to say, from the bar team. And I was watching them interacting with guests. And like you say, if you want to know more about the drinks, you can. If you don't, you don't. But they were like really energetic and smiley. And I noticed, and I loved this, every single person who walked in, they shouted hello to.
Yeah.
And I know it's a small thing, but it means a lot.
It's a big thing, absolutely. It means a lot. And we went there because we didn't want to go in the evening. We wanted to go at that sort of midpoint in the day. So we went about 4 or 5, I think. Yeah. And it was absolutely... when we went, there were just a few people, but... Yeah. By the time we were only there for an hour or something, it was packed by the time we left.
And
it was amazing,
was great, wasn't it? From
really,
the team
really
and
good.
From the guests.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And this is just 3 weeks in.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, exactly. So, what did you have, young fella Milad?
I had a mezcal sunset, and the reason I jumped to that, I'm on a bit of a mezcal journey. I think, you know, we've talked about this before. I never used to like it, and now I've really been getting into it in the last year or two. So saw mezcal sunset and I thought, okay, I'm not even going to drill into it. I'm just going to try that. It was a long drink. It looked really, and this is part of their style, I think, the free sheet style. It was a very elegant, understated drink. It was served in a highball glass with one of those long chunks of ice. And what I liked, it was, what's that word?
Graduation.
Graduating colour. So from sort of yellow through to orange. So it evoked
sunset.
That sunset. Mm. But that wasn't just a visual thing, because I was asking one of our lovely bartenders about it. And he said, and I'll be honest, I don't quite get the science of this, but he said there's sparkling ingredients at the top and still ingredients at the bottom. So as you sip it, they gradually
intermingle.
So as you sip, the drink changes its character, which it did. Mm. And the thing I should just tell you what's in this, by the way. So it is Ojo de Dios Joven Mezcal, Vulcan tequila, tangerine, marigold, and Earl Grey. It's a really interesting flavor combination. But what I loved first and foremost about it, after the color, was sometimes with long drinks, for me, I have one because they're refreshing, but then I'm a little bit disappointed because they've not got so much character. This couldn't be further away from that, because it looked good, it tasted good, and as I sipped it, you know, the balance of all those ingredients, it was just bang on. And it was really rewarding.
Yeah, I agree, because I tasted your...
You did.
Also, we should mention that Three Sheets, it takes its name from Three Sheets to the Wind, basically. But you can choose your drinks according to the intensity. One sheet is... I think yours was a one sheet. So that basically means that it's a bit lighter... Not light, but lighter. Sure, and then two sheets, it gets a little bit stronger. And then three sheets, obviously, is the three sheets. Which
brings us nicely on to your choice of drink.
Well, I went... If I remember it was rightly. Funny because, as I was saying, at the top of this episode, I was thinking that I wanted to make a dirty martini. Yeah. And funnily enough, they have a dirty martini on this list.
Synchronicity, is that the word I'm looking for?
Yeah, I think it is. But it's interesting. With the Soho branch, they don't want to be a carbon copy of the Dalston branch. Yeah. So they have totally different drinks from each other, apart from a few key things. including this dirty martini. Now, their dirty martini doesn't have the olive brine that I was doing right at the top of this. It's an amazing, beautifully balanced drink that takes a dirty martini into a completely different direction. So it's Belvedere vodka, Cosseret tea, olive oil, pickpool, and sea salt. So they're all of the elements that you taste when you're having the sort of dirty martini that I made.
Yeah, yeah.
But they've really refined it and really honed in on those nuances. And there's none of the cloudiness. There's none of that sort of oiliness as well that we've got from my one. Mm. Even though I like it, but this is clean, it's crisp, yeah. It's really refreshing, their version is. And they serve theirs with three olives. So that's why I just did the three olives garnish. It was, three olives, three sheets, absolutely amazing. And I saw some of the drinks and I really want to go back, particularly for the rhubarb and sake. And I think it's not just because we've just reviewed the sake, it just looked so beautiful. Again, this one had Belvedere vodka, sake, rhubarb, orris and Darjeeling and peony, but it looked gorgeous. It was in little sort of like one of those sort of school type of tumblers.
Yeah.
But the colour of it looked beautiful. So I'm going back for that.
Well, can I come with you? Because there's a couple of things I want to go back for. I was looking at the menu and I really want to go back for the Scottish coffee.
Yeah, I know you like the look of that.
You know, not just because later. Of my Scots heritage, obviously. But when I was looking through the ingredients, and it's obviously made with the Scotch whiskey, but also it says with shortbread cream. Mm. And I thought, I need that in my life.
Yeah.
So I'm going back for that a bit later. But the second thing I want to go back and have your dirty martini, because I sipped that and I thought it was brilliant. But we should just say they do a few little small dishes. And we saw somebody in the middle of the afternoon, well done her, having a dirty martini with some
oysters.
With
her oysters, I know. Her laptop as well. It was like she was
doing her best work life. Yeah. So big up to her, whoever she was. But I think I'd like to go back and have the oysters with your dirty martini.
Yes. Perfect. Yeah. Absolutely perfect. I mean, there's so many great things on this menu. And I also have to say that they were one of the first bars that did that real clean, classic looking drink, really minimalist.
Yeah, yeah.
And now everyone's doing it, but they do it really, really well. That is Three Sheets in Soho. But also, if you're East London or just popping into the UK, go to both, I would say. They're both really amazing. Bartender turned editor and now bar owner, Holly Graham puts the rest of us to shame, not just with her impressive workload, but her zest for life and infectious energy. But how did a girl from East London become one of the most influential voices on the drink scene in Asia, not just as managing editor of its lead publication Drink Magazine, but as the author of the seminal Cocktails of Asia? A book that shines a light on the people, stories and recipes from some of the major players in the region, including those in her beloved Hong Kong, the place where she's called home for the past 10 years. We catch up with her to get the lowdown on all of this, as well as hearing about her most recent and most character-building project to date, moving to Japan to open and run her first bar, Tokyo Confidential, where she invites guests to pull up, fess up, and let loose. We can't wait to hear more. Holly, welcome to the Cocktail Lovers podcast.
Thank you so much. Finally, I've made it onto my favourite podcast ever.
And finally, we get to talk to one of our favourite people on our podcast. So let's start, first of all, by warming ourselves up. Can you describe yourself in three words?
Oh, three words. I can do two. Oh, let's go three. All right. Multi-hyphenate bartender.
I love that. Brilliant. So before we get on to the bar, because there's a lot to talk about, tell us a bit about you and how a good old East Londoner became the toast of Asia.
I'm still trying to figure that out myself. But yeah, as you said, I am Council Estate, East London, born and bred, even though I don't sand it anymore. Yeah, so I was born and bred in Leytonstone, and I moved over to Asia when I was 21. So I've essentially spent most of my adult life here. I'm now almost 37, not ashamed to admit my age.
Oh, good for you.
But yeah, so, you know, I've grown up as most of my adult life here, and I moved over to Thailand as an English teacher. I'll try and keep this short. And then I moved over to Seoul in Korea for 2 years, then moved over to Hong Kong, where I started to realize I don't like kids and what the hell am I doing teaching them?
I think that's true of a lot of teachers, to be honest.
Yeah. And I've never wanted kids, like, don't plan to have them. So it was even more of a what the hell am I doing moment. But anyway, so in Hong Kong, I saw a lot more opportunity for journalists. And, you know, I sort of started out, as you know, that's how you and I met. You know, I started out in journalism. And again, this is the very long and short of it, but I worked my ass off freelancing to build up a portfolio, and ended up getting a job at Time Out Hong Kong as the food and drink editor. Again, I'm missing out all the grit and the struggle, but yeah, so I was there for a couple of years. And Time Out, as you very well know, is started in London, and basically all the licenses elsewhere were franchised and we got taken over. So all the franchises got bought back and there was a huge management reshuffle. Everyone got fired except three of us. And we basically had to keep, you know, this prestigious brand alive, and it was a lot of pressure. It was really hard. And after, I think, like a year or so, and this was like the dawn of SEO as well. So, you know, we're having to learn to switch from print to, you know, how we search engine optimize all our articles. And it started to really take the magic out of writing for me, you know, writing listicles and things like that. So I kind of just lost it in the middle of an editorial meeting one day. I was, you know, my editorial director at the time was not the most pleasant of people. And it was really one of those, like, something snapped in my brain and I clapped my hands down on the table. I said, fuck this, and walked out.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And I went to drown my sorrows at my favorite bar at the time, which was the Old Man in Hong Kong, which was being run by Agong Prabowal, who was the founder. And he said to me, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. Do you want to give me a job? And he was like, yeah, all right then. When can you start? Tomorrow? And I was thrust very quickly into the craft bartending world. So I'd had experience in hospitality. You know, my parents met running a cafe in Tottenham opposite White Hart Lane. I grew up running plates in cafes as a kid. Got the asbestos fingers to prove it. I worked at bars at university, but never, you know, never the caliber of the Old Man, which, you know, after 2 years of working there, we went on to win the best bar in Asia on Asia's 50 Best and number 5 in the world, I believe. And it was just the best baptism of fire. You know, I suddenly was thrust into this world and traveling, and I finally found people that spoke my language. I found my tribe. You know, I felt like I'd never felt like a black sheep, but I'd always kind of got on with everyone, but I'd never really gelled with a group or a career. And then suddenly it all just made sense. I was like, this is where I'm meant to be, the bar industry. This is it, you know? And yeah, so then that led me on to, I went back to writing. So I then became the managing editor of Drink Magazine Asia, which, much like yourselves, is a trade publication, the biggest in Asia. And I loved it. I really loved writing for the trade side of things and getting nerdy. And I think our dear friend Hamish Smith once said to me that Holly took the method actor's approach, because I said to him, if I'm going to write about bars and bartending, then I need to learn how to. So I was,
yeah, that is the method acting bit, isn't it, really?
Yeah. So I was simultaneously writing and bartending, and, you know, I had to pack in the bartending eventually. But then that's when, I don't know, I guess, like, people, I like to have fun behind the bar, and I was very fortunate to get guest shifts in my own right, you know, as Holly Graham, not representing a bar, and I kind of was doing both simultaneously. And yeah, was at Drink for, God, well, I'm still technically there, but pulled back a little bit, obviously, to open my bar. And then leads me up until where we are now, where a year ago I got a phone call from a friend of an acquaintance saying they wanted to open a bar. And again, one thing led to another. And here I am living in Tokyo and opening my first bar, Tokyo Confidential.
Bloody hell. I mean, it is quite incredible because I wonder if any of that would have happened if you'd stayed in London. You know, I mean, why was it, first of all, that what drew you to Asia?
I don't know. It's interesting you say that. I do think that very often, you know, over my many years in Asia, I'm like, what if, you know, it's a domino effect, it's sliding doors, it's everything, right? You know, I look back at every negative, you know, it's funny, like, I split up with my ex in Korea and we were meant to move to Spain together. And if we hadn't split up, I wouldn't have moved to Hong Kong, you know, all this stuff. But to answer your question, what originally drew me here was just, I wanted something different. I graduated in 2008. And as you know, the recession was rough in London. And, you know, I'd spent all this money at university to be told that, yeah, the world's your oyster, you'll get a job, to be landed with a shitload of debt and nothing, you know, nothing to do. And I was living with my mum. Felt really aimless. The one job that I did get, because I originally wanted to work in TV and be a scriptwriter. And the one job that I did have that could have sent me on that path, I got made redundant from, and it really took the wind out of my sails. So I remember seeing this advert for teaching in Thailand, and they kind of took care of everything. And I thought, you know, how can I work abroad and earn money? And it just seemed like the easiest option. So I took a sort of baseline qualification of a month and I just fell in love. I loved living. Every day was a challenge. Sometimes, you know, for better, for worse. But I don't know. Again, I feel like I fit in more here. I love London. I love it. And it always feels magic when I come back. But I don't feel like a Londoner anymore. It's funny. I was just recently taking Tokyo Confidential on tour in the US. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of jokes being a 6-foot blonde woman about how, well, yeah, you look like you're from Japan. But it's like... It's almost like I vehemently have to justify, like, oh, well, I'm from England, but I'm not really English. Even though I sound it and I look it, I don't feel it. You know, I feel at home wherever I live. I think truly in my heart, I feel like a Hong Konger. I lived there for a decade and it will always feel like home. But yeah, I'm a mixed bag. And I just, like I said, kind of like the bar industry, I just felt at home in Asia. It felt like my people and my place, you know.
So that's really interesting. I love that because I've always wanted to ask how you got to Asia and where you fit in and how you feel about it, because you're saying now that you don't feel like a Londoner anymore. Is that right?
Yeah. Like even when I come back, it's still like, I remember, I think I'd been gone for about a year and a half was my longest stint away after being away for like 4 years, and I had real reverse culture shock. Like it was really weird coming back to London. I just didn't know where anything was. Obviously being an East Londoner, a lot of that changed in the Olympics, you know? So, and you know, I grew up on, like I said, a really rough council estate where there was, you know, I wasn't allowed to go to Hackney or Dalston. And now that's the only places I drink when I'm home. You know, that's where all the good cocktail bars are. It's so different.
Before we get on to Tokyo Confidential, tell us about working in a bar. What was the most important thing that you learned when you worked at the Old Man?
I think it was one thing that always stuck with me from Agung, who I always credit as, you know, one of my greatest mentors, because he was no shit, but he was never harsh. You know, he would correct you, but it was very to the point. There was no not ego, what's the word, like there was no venom to it. It was always like, do this, do that, do this, because he wanted you to be better. And I think the most important thing that I took away was just like that I love, like everyone in hospitality says, like I love making people happy, I love being silly. And I think the greatest thing about hospitality is you can be the center of attention whilst always also making someone else the center of attention, if that makes sense. So, you know, all eyes are on you, but you're also giving someone an experience that makes them feel like the center of your universe and makes them feel incredibly special. And I think that was my biggest takeaway, because I'm sorry, if anyone in hospitality says that they don't want to be the center of attention, they are fucking lying. And look, I think it's not my joke, but it's a joke that I glom onto, is that a lot of bartenders and hospitality professionals are just rock stars that never learned an instrument. I love being behind the bar and dancing and being silly and, you know, getting on top of the bar and pouring laybacks and savoring champagne. But also because other people vibe off of that energy, like watching a performer on stage. You know, you're experiencing their energy, you're seeing them loving it, so you love it as well. It's such a symbiotic energy, you know.
And so how did your bar career, would you say, how does that translate into your work as a writer?
I think, like, going back to what I said, I mean, they're both creative industries, right? And I remember, like I said, when I had this wind knocked out of my sails, I remember crying to my mum and I said, oh, I have no discernible talent, don't play instruments, I'm not good at sport or anything like this. And my mum always said to me, she was like, you're a really talented writer, Holly. And I was like, no, bullshit, no, I'm not. Yes, not everyone can do it. And it wasn't until I started to develop in my writing career and have interns when I realized, oh, not everyone can actually write.
Yeah.
And I think, like I said, so when I was at Time Out, I loved writing about food, but eventually I started to get bored of it. And I love the nerdiness and the intricacy of booze. And I think that's where it marries up, right? We're all nerds in the bar industry. We all get really nerdy about things. And I don't know, it's hard to explain how they marry up. And like, you know, that's what led me to writing my book. I was like, how do I marry my greatest loves, which is advocating for the bar industry in Asia and writing and bartending? And that culminated in what I call my love letter, Cocktails of Asia, which I published, I think it was May 2021 now.
2 years ago.
Yeah. So yeah. Yeah. 2 years, yeah. So time to start getting work on that.
You've had such a great career, Holly. And I mean, this is only still the beginning, I think, you know. So before we get onto the bar, again, I keep saying before we get onto the bar, but tell us about some of the key people in your career and also some of the pivotal moments, and then we'll get onto the bar.
Yeah, I think, like I said, Agung, I will always credit him. I call him Dad. He's been such a mentor and a father figure to me.
He's fabulous.
Yeah, he's just the absolute best. And one of the things about leaving Hong Kong was, you know, it tore me apart to leave him. And if you trawl back down my Instagram, there's a very wonderful post of us just holding each other and sobbing. You know, he's just sort of, I don't know, he saw that I wanted it and I was eager, and he I feel like he gave me the world, you know, and I really, really appreciate that, because, you know, once upon a time he was nobody and someone gave him a chance. And I think a lot of people don't do that in their careers. They just, nobody remembers where they came from, and he did, you know. My best friend, Beckley Franks, is, you know, my lifelong cheerleader, love of my life. I've never met someone who I love and loves me back so equally, you know, outside of obviously my husband. But our love for each other is just ridiculous, you know.
It's
just
beautiful. Yeah.
And, you know, again, obviously she's a renowned bartender, so I'm more than happy to take advice and criticism and feedback from her. And she's always, you know, at first I remember she'd be like, you're not a bartender, what are you doing? Not in a critical way, but she would laugh. And now she looks at me and she's just like, my, how you've grown. You know, she, again, if Agung's my dad, Beckley's my best friend and my mom.
No, yeah.
And obviously I would be hugely remiss to not give my husband, Tom Edgerton, a shout out, who has been doing this a lot bloody longer than I have. And, you know, again, I truly wouldn't be here without him. He's the method to my madness. And that's becoming even more apparent now that we've opened the bar. Like, we've really realized how our skills complement one another.
Have you worked together before in that kind of capacity, that closeness? Because it is quite intense working with your husband.
Not really. Like, I mean, obviously, you know, we met when he was running Potato Head Hong Kong and I was at Time Out. So there was some crossovers. You know, Tom was renowned for being, you know, big in sustainability and bartending. So, you know, when I wrote articles, I'd always defer to him. We did a few little guest shifts together, but yeah, nowhere near the level of what we're doing now. We'd run a few events together. You know, we did some charity stuff in Hong Kong, but yeah, this is next level. This is our business together. You know, this is 50-50.
So, right, now tell us about it, because we've hinted about it. It's called Tokyo Confidential. You started to say how it came about. You got a phone call. Tell us then how it all evolved.
Yeah, so essentially my now business partner, and it is funny, if I track back a little bit more, my mum always said to me, she said, bartenders, you bar industry people, you don't care about LinkedIn, but I honestly think you should focus on it and blah, blah, blah. So I always kept my LinkedIn, you know, not it was up to date enough. It wasn't, you know, anywhere near as manicured and updated as my Instagram, but I kept it up to a certain level. And I got a message from my now business partner who, you know, I kind of got this message and I was like, oh, whatever, bro. You know, he just said something along the lines of, you know, I'm looking to open a bar in Tokyo. Your name came up. We basically had a mutual friend. His friend used to work in a bar in Hong Kong, and she and I used to drink together, a Japanese girl. He was like, yeah, mutual friend of Ruri. Anyway, so I was like, okay, yeah, cool. I'm all ears. So we got on a phone call, like a Zoom actually. And, you know, I hate the word, like, it really was a vibe check. It was, the gut feeling was there, and we really sort of had a good time. Everything felt really right. And I, you know, I said to him also, oh, my husband's in the industry. And he said, great, when can you come over? And at the time, the borders of Hong Kong and Japan were one of the last to open in COVID. I'm talking October 2023 was wow. when our borders opened without
really?
Quarantine.
Wow.
And so we hadn't planned to go back to either of our respective homes because Tom's from New Zealand, obviously I'm from London. So we were like, fuck it, let's go to Japan at Christmas. Business partner flies us out. We have a great time. Again, gut feeling's all right. It's all good. And it started off as a potential consultancy. And the more and more invested that we got, we were just like, what? You know, we've been in Hong Kong a decade. We love it. I didn't particularly want to leave. And don't get me wrong, I spent months crying my eyes out, just like, oh my God, what the hell am I doing? I'm going to move to Japan. But we just got so invested in the idea and the concept that it made sense that we had to move over here, you know? So yeah, moved over in September 12th of last year, and opened the bar on October 11th.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So,
that is,
you know,
crazy. Absolutely crazy. But, you know, it's one of those things. Sometimes you get those opportunities. Sometimes you might pass them by, but it is a gut thing, isn't it? You can only go with your gut, and that's what it was telling you. So where was your business partner based? Was he from Tokyo, or what was his
story? He's essentially American Japanese. He was born in Indonesia, moved to America when he was 10, very Californian, and then moved to Japan when he was 22, married to a Japanese woman. But he's very, I call him American Japanese, you know, because he gets it. And it's been amazing because, you know, he spent essentially 50% of his life in the US, 50% here. And he made a success for himself by doing things differently. You know, this is his first F&B venture, first bar venture. So he's been amazing and defaulted essentially to Tom and I, zero interference. He trusts us.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
And I feel lucky, you know, because I don't have to say names. We've all seen plenty of our peers go through the absolute fucking ringer with business partners, and it's scary. So, you know, I kept my business partner on his toes by being like, this happened to my friend and this happened to my friend, and I can't do this if you're going to do this to me, you know? So we all made sure we're all protected on all sides, but hey, fingers crossed it all works out. Yeah. But so far, so good.
Tell us about the concept. How did you go about, you know, developing that? And what is it? Describe the bar to us.
A lot of the bar, it's been so weird, right? And it's just like, I don't think I'm the only creative person that goes through this process, but I'll kind of just like, I'll sit there and I'll be like, what the fuck? I've got no ideas. Nothing's coming up. You can't force it out. And then suddenly from nowhere, bam, it just slaps you in the face. You know, it's like, here's an idea. And I'd spent a long time. We found the site and we got this beautiful view of Tokyo Tower. For those of you that aren't familiar, it's a structure very similar to the Eiffel Tower, and it's lit up in orange. It's stunning. It's a real beacon and icon of Tokyo. And I sort of went back to the drawing board and I thought, right, let's do a Wikipedia search of Tokyo Tower. What is it? What does it do? What's the point of it? When was it built? You know, I thought something will come up out of this. And essentially, you know, it's a radio tower. It's a communication tower. And that's where I started thinking about it. And as I've always said, I mean this with absolutely zero disrespect to the Japanese bar scene. I love Japanese bartending. I love Japanese bars. They're incredible. But I think something that is missing in Japanese bars, or something that they do differently, is they're not a space for communication. They're a space where you go and you watch this beautiful you know, very stylistic bartending. You don't really talk to the bartender. You don't really talk to your companion. You're there to watch art, essentially.
Yeah, it's about reverence, isn't it, in a way?
Exactly, yeah. Mm. You're watching art being created. A lot of Japanese bars, you can't even talk to people. You can't take photos, you know, and it's very, or they're listening bars and things like this. So I was like, what can I add? I never wanted, you know, I'm never there to fucking co-opt a culture. I'm extremely hyper aware that I'm a white woman in Asia. So I'm not, you know, out here to co-opt anything. So I thought, what can I add that's different? And I thought, you know, just make a space that's designed for revelry is kind of the opposite of that quiet and just like, kind of like me. I like, you know, like I said, I'm from the ghetto, from the block, but I still love my caviar and champagne, you know.
Holly from the block, I love it.
Yeah, swear like a fishwife, but still love, you know, still love a glass of Krug and a craft cocktail. So I tried to make the bar into like, what would I be if I was a bar? You know, so it's like I said, it's a space for communication. It's a space to be who you want to be unashamedly. And that's kind of where the confidential part comes from. And I kind of hate saying it because it sounds weird and oxymoronic, but something we always said is like the bar is a place to be your confidential self. So a lot of Japan is, you know, you suit up, you don't show your feelings, you go to your workplace and things are really hard and you just get on with it. And we wanted people to walk into our bar and just like go like, fuck that. I'm going to be who I want to be.
This
I'm gonna
is be- me.
Yeah. This is me. I'm going to do, you know, you want to drink champagne, you want to drink cocktails, you want to drink non-alcs, you want to dance, you want to sit by yourself, you want to go on a date, whatever the fuck you want to do, do it at Tokyo Confidential, you know? And that kind of ties into our little motto became pull up, fess up, you know, so pull up to the bar, confess your sins and alleviate yourself. It's
and
meant
then
to be
get
like,
on with it.
Yeah. Like brush it off and just get on with it and have a good time. And I love that, you know, the bars kind of become symbiotic. Like there are nights that it's a bit more candlelit and quiet. And then there's nights where it's just downright rowdy. Like our original working sort of title was Tokyo House Party, but it didn't really translate because they call it home party here. So we wanted it to feel like, and as cheesy as it sounds. So basically in the pandemic, my husband and I moved out to very rural Hong Kong so we could have a bit more space. And we had like this half of, you know, half an apartment left that we didn't know what to do with because we'd lived in this tiny studio. So we built a bar in our house. And we always said, so in Hong Kong, we built a bar in our house. And in Tokyo, we're turning our bar into your house.
Oh, nice. So, lovely.
Even though it doesn't look like it, it's meant to have that sort of like hanging around the kitchen after, not after party, but, you know, like.
Yeah, just, that kitchen vibe.
Yeah, exactly. And just like hanging around chatting shit, you know. And people love it. And, you know, a lot of people tell me it wouldn't work and it seems to be doing all right so far.
And what does it look like? So there's the kitchen feel. What sort of size and, you know, what's the feel, the look of it?
Yeah, so we're really lucky that we've got this like very alfresco balcony that we can like push the doors all the way open to extend the space. But obviously Japan is much like the UK has four very distinct seasons. So we've got heaters out there at the moment because I cannot afford to lose half my venue just because it's cold, because we also have a rooftop as well, like a roof space. So we have this beautiful horseshoe shaped bar, because I always, after working at the Old Man, for those who aren't familiar with the Old Man, it's kind of like an I-shaped bar counter. So there was one station at the top and people would sit round it kind of like a communal table. And I'd always, since working there, I thought if I ever opened a bar, I want it to be like that. So this, we've got a horseshoe shaped bar, the bar counter's all flush. So, you know, the bartender's on the same level, basically with the, you know, where you sit, you watch directly what the bartender's doing. You can sit opposite one another. You can pull right up to the bartender if you want, and sit, you know, sit right next to them, chat to them. You can bugger off onto the balcony and like, you know, look at the beautiful view. Or we got booth seating, which is a bit more sort of, you know, the date spot where people snuggle up in the corner. And yeah,
our something for everyone.
Yeah. And another thing we always say is like, I call us the house of high contrast. So, you know, we've got this big stupid Godzilla custom cocktail fountain that literally pisses martinis out of it. And it's just my
heaven.
Yeah. And then we've got this beautiful 300-year-old reclaimed shrine wood bar top, you know, that's carved into this horseshoe shape. we've got this ridiculous, and it wasn't even that expensive, Gucci wallpaper. And then I've got like stupid toys, like, I hide toys around the bar for people to find. So that's what I mean about contrast. Like, there's just so much different shit going on.
Oh, it's fabulous. And how is it going down? How does it fit into the Tokyo scene?
I think I like to think, you know, it's still early days, but people, for example, yesterday we had guest bartender, very dear friend of ours, Jay Khan from Koa in Hong Kong, and his partner, Ajit Garung, who just opened another bar called Savory Project. And they delivered an agave masterclass. And whilst I know the industry wasn't there for me, it was really nice to see like some of the legends of Japan turn up because I'd invited them, you know, and they've been really supportive. And, you know, they're like, I get that nod of approval. Japanese people were never like sort of explicitly be like, your bar's fucking rad.
But no.
People, you know, like people like Kayama-san, who I respect incredibly, like from Bar Benfidic, he just, you know, I get that little wink and the thumbs up and the nod. And I know like that means the world to me, you know. And then, you know, you've got the sort of younger crowd, and there is a few more sort of expats out here now. You've got Keith Motsi, who's been here about a year and a half now, who's running Virtue in Tokyo. And I think, you know, from what people have told us, they really appreciate that people like Keith and I, we're not quiet, right? We're noisy fuckers. And, you know, I always say like a high tide raises all ships. And I think that people see that here, and they see that the noise I'm making is not just for myself. It's for everyone. I want everyone to have the light on them, you know. And it's, again, I think coming up in the industry in Hong Kong taught me, because Hong Kong's so small and everything is literally on top of each other, that you cannot be competitive with people. You have to be like, cool, one more bar in my neighborhood means more visitors, more spotlight, you know. And I think the Japanese scene, I really want to help build a community. And I think that people, you know, it hasn't been that tight here, but I'm trying to help sort of bring people together a little bit more, I hope. You know, maybe after this podcast goes out, someone will be like, leave us the fuck alone, Holly, we're fine.
Like, oh, stop it. Stop it. How is it being a woman in Japan, a woman bar owner? Are there many?
Oh my God, this is a whole fucking different ball game that I was not used to. Pardon my cursing. So this is one thing I'm actually really struggling with at the moment. And I had a big chat about it last night, funnily enough. And it's hard, right? Because I feel like I've spent my career championing not only Asia, but women in Asia as well, because it is hard here. But I was fortunate enough to be in Hong Kong, where things are pretty equal. Hong Kong's very accepting and multicultural, and, you know, there's no sort of cultural taboos that like there are in, say, Japan or Korea. And I am treated so differently as a woman here that it's kind of fucking heartbreaking and frustrating at times, you know. I don't, you know, people will say things like, oh, isn't it lovely that you moved over here with your husband to open his bar? Like, I'm just second fiddle or something, you know. Or men will come into the bar, usually, unfortunately, Japanese men, and they won't even look at me in the eye and be like, I want to see the manager. Like, I don't know, maybe there might be sales reps or whatever, you know, they're not complaining, and they won't even look at me. And I'm like, hi, I'm the owner, how can I help you? And they're like, no, I want to see the manager. And I'm like, you can't go higher level than me, bro. You know, like, it's me or nothing. And they won't listen to me. And then, you know, my venue manager is a Japanese guy, and they'll just default to him. And it's just like, it's heartbreaking, because I spent so long, so hard, but it also gives me the kick up the ass to be like, right, okay, well, if I'm struggling, then what do other women feel like, you know? And there's not, there is a lot of female bar owners here, but, you know, I'm hoping we can get together and do more stuff together, because it is, if I'm struggling, I can't even imagine how they feel, you know?
Yeah, and also, it's not like you're frightened of coming forward, whereas some people would be much more. Do you know what I mean? So hopefully we'll hear more about that, and you building your community again there. It's quite incredible that it's sort of so far behind in that way. It's like, here we go again, you know?
Yeah, it's sad and disappointing, you know, but it's not unexpected, I will say.
So what's the best thing about being in Tokyo at the moment?
Oh, my God. Like, on just that everything is, it's a real roller coaster. And this is something, again, I'm really struggling with the emotional whiplash at the moment. Like there's been some real, I think, you know, the last few years in Hong Kong was kind of, COVID aside, everything was pretty stable. And I think that's the reason that we left as well, is because we were comfortable, but we knew we could do better and do bigger and
do
all
more.
This shit. You know? Mm. Yeah, do more. So like there is some real highs and lows here, but I get to live in Japan. How dope is that? You know, like, you know, Tom and I will walk down the street and sometimes we'll look at each other and we'll be like, we live in fucking Japan.
I know. Wow. It's incredible.
One thing that I really enjoy as well is having lived in Hong Kong for 10 years is whilst it's beautiful and there's a lot of, you know, nature and incredible things that you can do in Hong Kong that people don't realize, is that it's not a place that you can travel, right? Because it's so tiny. It's made up of a series of islands and then the part that's connected to mainland China. But I love that I can hop on a bullet train and in 2 hours I can be in, like, especially at the moment because it's winter, I can be in like a snowy winter wonderland, or I can go hiking, or I can go to Fuji, or, you know, there's just so much different stuff. And like, I can't wait till summer and I can go to Okinawa or go to the beaches or whatever. It's just like, it's just amazing. It's a bit of a head fuck, if I'm honest. Like, I love it, but I'm not quite sure how I feel about it or if I ever get used to it, you know?
Yeah, well, that's good as well, though, isn't it? And what's the best thing about being Holly Graham?
Oh, God. It's not easy being Holly Graham. She is riddled with ADHD and often get myself in trouble. But I don't know. I think I'm one thing, you know, I guess we're Brits, right? We're not meant to talk about, we're taught not to sort of big ourselves up and talk like that. But I really appreciate the way that I was raised and to be forthright and unashamedly myself. And it took me a long time to get here. I think being in an industry that accepts me has really helped. But I don't know. I just think my work ethic as well. And again, like, I feel like I'm crediting myself, but these are all things that my parents instilled in me, is to be, you know, to not be scared, to be bolshy, to work hard, but also take care of myself at the same time, you know, because obviously hustle culture is toxic. But yeah. And, you know, I'm very lucky to have a mother that tells me every fucking day how proud she is of me, you know.
Oh. And that means a lot, eh? You know,
yeah. It's
fantastic. And also, I would say your passion, the fact that you are a kick-ass woman, you're absolutely brilliant. And I love that fact that you said, you know, you are the party, but you make sure that people are part of that party as well. So that is an incredible superpower. And that's the reason, or one of the many reasons, that I love you. So it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you, Holly. And I can't wait to get to Tokyo to see you. And I implore anybody that is visiting Tokyo to pop in and see you as well, because the bar sounds amazing. And if it's anything like any of the guest shifts I've ever seen you at, it is a winner.
Thank you. Yeah, like Sandra said, if you come by, look for the tall blonde one, the tall blonde loud one, you can't miss me.
Definitely not. Thank you so much, Holly. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. And just a little side note, I wanted to say my cup was very empty today and now it feels very full just from talking to you. This is really...
Oh, I love you.
The ass I needed.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cocktail Lovers podcast. We really hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please tell your friends and make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. For more details on the people, places and products mentioned today, head over to our website, thecocktaillovers.com.